Welcome, boys and girls. Thank you so much for tuning in today. You are listening to Red Eyes Radio. This is Henrik, and it's a pleasure to have you with us. The website is redeyescreations.com, redeyesradio.net, and also redeyesmembers.com for the full show for you guys who enjoy what we do here. We have the publisher of Mjolnir magazine with us today, Dave Yorkshire, to discuss how to further a Eurocentric revival in the creative arts. This program is about how to not only demolish the modern progressive degenerate arts, but also how to lift up our own again and move towards tradition, Eurocentrism, illiberalism, and elitism. And when I say elitism, I don't mean the misleading elites or the hostile elites that we have today. We've had enough of that, thank you. I'm talking about a true elite, a righteous leadership, a return of the king, someone who actually cares for the people that they are leading. You might be surprised to learn how much of the mess that we're in, and then consequently a revival of something good, can begin with the arts, culture, literature, and film, as opposed to lobby groups and politics. Welcome, Dave. Thank you so much for coming on the program with us. It's good to have you here today.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Well, very good. This is going to be an interesting show. I'm glad to have you here talking more about your magazine, talking more about the state of art, what role art has both in our society today, but also, of course, what role art has in terms of turning the tide, if you will, and trying to reverse some of the trends that we've been seeing unfolding really since the Second World War in a kind of pace that we haven't seen before. But before we kind of get into some of the details here and talk more about some of the things you've done, just tell us a little bit about Mjolnir and the name and why you wanted to start the magazine, Dave.
It's a very good question. I suppose the idea came about probably 4 years ago, something like that. I was at a pan-nationalist conference. It's called the BNP Ideas Conference. I was a member of the BNP at that time. Not perhaps the most intelligent decision I made looking back. But it was a party with its problems. It was a very successful party, actually, the most successful nationalist party that there's probably been. But, of course, it was taken down by the egotism of its leader, Nick Griffin, but also because of the, well, sort of a modernist, modernizing project. They allowed in people who wanted to moderate its image, things like that, and it sort of fractured into his internal disputes, and the leader kind of went with the moderates, really. Although he kind of went with anyone who, you know, kind of supported him, really, I suppose. Anyway, this conference was about how to kind of, how nationalism in general in Britain was to go forward. And I gave a little speech, really metapolitically, how culturally we should progress. Basically, that we were doing things the wrong way around. We were putting the cart before the horse. And really, you had to have a vibrant culture before you got successful politically. That's something that I stand by now. And so I'm sort of trying to build the foundations of something political, sort of after the event, if you like, which is pretty difficult. You know, you if you have a tree, you've got to have roots for the tree before you get leaves. That's the thing. And so I stood up and I talked about the need for a cultural movement. And I said that, you know, it should start with an artistic magazine. Now, my idea back then was that Jonathan Bowden, I don't know if you know Jonathan Bowden.
Sure.
Do you know Jonathan Bowden?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah, okay. I wanted him to lead it. I contacted him. Unfortunately, he was very ill at the time. We didn't know how ill. Of course, he died several months later. And so there was no one really around to spearhead it. So I kind of took it upon myself. And that's how it got started, really. I started with a website. There's a wonderful woman called Alice. She got involved. She's very experienced with website building. She built the website for me. I kind of went around looking for artists, appealed to people, and eventually sort of a year later, we got the first magazine finished, which was you know, it's quite difficult. Probably everything that was imaginable that could have gone wrong did go wrong. I thought that it had been cursed by a team of rabbis or something, but because we had so much misfortune with it. And so that was one of the reasons why it took a year from the first issue to the second. We've got the second issue out now. It's better than the first issue, I must say, because, of course, with the first issue of anything, you make really every mistake it's conceivable to make. And so, you know, when I look at the first issue, although I've been told that, you know, it's very good and everything, but I only see the errors. But, you know, that's my nature, I suppose, as an artist and everything, that you only see the flaws.
Exactly. Well, that's good. That leads you to understanding what needs to be improved and all that. So that's, and it's good to make the mistakes early on too, right? To
make that's right. So you know, we ironed a lot of the mistakes out for the second issue. The second issue I'm largely very happy with, although of course, you know, I always think, well, there's this and the other that can be improved for the next issue. But, you know, if it continues to improve, continues to get better, then that's a wonderful thing. You know, you always strive as an artist, as whatever, you know, any kind of elitist, you always strive to get better, to improve for the next one. And that's a, you know, that's a philosophy that I've always had throughout my life in whatever I've done, really. And we should get the third issue out at the end of this year. I've already had excellent contributions for the third issue. So work kind of on finalizing it will be done in October. I'll get it to the printers at the end of October, and then it should be ready for me to pick up around Christmas time, or Yuletide, I should say.
Well, exactly. There you go. Now, we'll talk more about the magazine later, some of the things that you have, you know, in it and whatnot. But tell us first, what attracted you to the BNP then initially? I mean, were you always on this page? I mean, because that in itself is a major step that most people never end up taking.
Yeah, it's very true. Difficult to explain, really. I suppose I'd better start with, giving you a bit of autobiography. I went to university quite late in life. I was in my late 20s when I went to university. I had a career as, you know, kind of average everyday worker before that. And I went to university, first of all, to college, and then to university. And I was in the liberal arts, and I thought something is quite wrong here. These people are basically telling me things, you know, to get me to hate my own culture. Why is that? What's going on here? These people are meant to be the custodians of our culture. They're meant to, you know, want you to be proud of your own culture. That's their job. And so I thought, well, I've got to find out what the hell's going on here. And so I did a lot of reading. Most university students don't read. That's a fact of the matter. They kind of, you know, want to go out partying, drinking, and will accept anything that the professors tell them so that they can kind of get on, get their 2-1 or whatever, get out, and have a good time of it before they have to start work. With me, it wasn't the case. I'd already been out to work. I was already matured and fully formed as an adult, really. And I think that was the major difference between these people. You know, these people are still teens, of course, when they go to university, early 20s at the maximum. They're not really fully formed. They're not, you know, they don't have their own ideas or anything. An idea is provided for them through experience. I think that's a crucial difference, that I've been out into the world and experienced it and could formulate my own opinions from that. Whereas these people were being given received opinions and digesting them to get grades. And that's how university works. That's really why we're in almost the mess that we're in. Because people, and this is not a criticism of most people, you know, most people don't think that's the mass. But that's the mass in any given society, and that's not to criticize the mass either. You know, I am an elitist. I believe that, well, for a start, society wouldn't function if everyone was a, you know, an intellectual or a thinker or whatever, or everyone was a leader. You know, it would fragment, you know, because everyone would be pulling in their own direction and everything. You need a mass for a society to function. But the problem is that the custodians of culture, they've gone. They've, you know, really they're mentally perverted, I would probably say, and often quite sexually perverted as well. And you can see that whenever they speak, you know, this is why they're kind of attracted to Freudianism and things like that. But and so, having gone to university and discovered, you know, things like Frankfurt School theory, there's also the Constant School that came after that, deconstruction theory, post-colonial theory, third wave feminist theory. All these the theories that are kind of underpinning this corrosive culture that we have now, that will ultimately spell the doom of the West if it's allowed to continue.
I agree.
I thought, you know, yeah. And so I thought, well, what can I do about this? And so rather than, you know, a political party normally goes out and tries to recruit people, I went to it. It's completely the other way around. I went, you know, what can I do about this? I've got to find something, you know. And obviously the British National Party was even then reasonably prominent because, of course, the news was full of it. The news was always saying how evil and wicked and despicable this party is. And I thought, that's the party for me. so I went out and joined it. But the other reason I joined is quite personal, actually. My best friend, he died of leukemia in his early 30s. And while he was dying of leukemia, because it took him a year, he was having to go to the office where you get benefits in the UK, the Department of Social Services, and pleading with them to help his family. You know, he'd got, at the time he'd got two young sons and one on the way. It was quite tragic. And a wife and everything. And he had to, you know, literally walk into that establishment with the drip and everything and walk in, and he sat down, you know, in front of them and said, look, I'm dying. I've paid my taxes. Can't you help me? You know, and yet they kept, you know, trying to fob him off and, you know, and not pay him and things like that. You know, taxes which basically he'd earned in case there ever was something wrong with him. And, of course, they're giving all this money away to such as these, again, these asylum seekers that are coming in now. You know, they yep. They've got their hands out. They get it filled straight away, and yet the people who, the honest European people who build this civilization, who continue this civilization, they, you know, if anything happens to them, they're kind of sent away with a flea in their ear. And I thought, this is entirely wrong. This is wrong. And so I joined the British National Party with the hope of doing something politically, which, as I say, was perhaps a mistake, but it was an honest one. The British National Party became such an embarrassment with the internal corruption in it.
Right.
I remember I was actually going to stand as a candidate in the 2010 general election, and you know, I put my name down. They said, "Oh, brilliant! You know, we need £2,000 for you for, you know, for leafleting for this and the other." I said, "I can't afford £2,000. What, you know, what about if I, you know, if I create my own leaflets and go around with that?" "Oh, no! We'll get someone else." So that's what they did. And I later found out that it was actually £300 for leafleting. for printing the leaflets and all that. But someone was obviously trying to make money out of me, which was the Yorkshire Regional Office. I still have the emails about that. And that kind of disillusioned me with the whole British National Party. I suppose all parties are the same, really, but, well, apart from, the National Front is full of good people, I'll say that. But there's some, I suppose, some bad people in all parties. But I thought that the British National Party would be different because I thought that it stood for a cause that was noble. And it turned out that it was full of charlatans and shysters, just the same as any other party, really. So that's the only reason that I regret my time in the British National Party.
Yeah, they weren't hard enough, they weren't decisive enough, and they didn't do enough, really.
Well, that's another reason. Now, they had over £1 million donated over the period, and what did they have to show for it? Of course, allegations have been made about the leader at the time, Nick Griffin, that he siphoned a lot of money away, especially from the Trafalgar Club funds. And of course, I can't say that is definitely true or not, but certainly it's very much a shady character. And when it came to that, there would be a leadership election. Originally, it was going to be Richard Edmonds. I don't know Richard Edmonds very well. I'll be honest. We've met on one occasion. That's all. I appealed to Andrew Bronze to stand against Nick Griffin. I wrote him several emails about it. Basically, instead of Richard Edmonds, because Richard Edmonds wasn't so well known, that was the only reason. Richard Edmonds is a good man. Andrew Bronze is also a good man. And so I and other people tried to get Andrew Bronze to stand against him. And of course, he lost by, I think it was 9 votes. Although, one of the amazing things was that Nick Griffin, he mocked postal voting all the time for elections, and said he was open to corruption, and yet he mysteriously got 500 postal votes to keep him in the leadership. So, well, that's the measure of the man, really.
Right. So what about your interest in art and your decision to focus on this as opposed to politics for an avenue to find a solution to many of these problems? I mean, tell us a bit about that, because you said for us having a vibrant culture, that aspect is so important. I mean, people need to know, first of all, what they are preserving, protecting, and procuring. If people don't know what this is, or even what their culture is, they will never be the guardians of it. They can't. So what role does art have in helping people to see what's wrong with Europe today?
That's a very good question. And, well, to begin with the first question you asked, which was about sort of why I changed from politics to the arts, I actually had no interest in politics going to university. I wanted to be a university professor in the arts, but realized quite quickly that wouldn't be the case, because I would have to go along with, the things that they're saying, because if you're not kind of a left liberal, or a cultural Marxist or whatever you want to call it, then you're not in the club and you don't get any further. So the other thing I wanted to do, and I'd already done, was to kind of leave my mark, if you like, on the arts. I'd had poetry published already. But again, it seemed to me that, they were asking for something that I wasn't particularly willing to give them, something kind of deconstructive, something that was anti-traditional, anti-European, etc., etc. And so I thought, well, you know, I've got to kind of create my own structure somehow. And so that was also a kind of germ of an idea for the magazine. But yes, on the second question you asked, which was about, you know, culture in society and how it forms society. Well, the reason, of course, why they guard culture so jealously, our new elite, is because, you know, this is what underpins society. Culture underpins society because these are ideas that you internalize without even thinking. It goes into the very bedrock of society and into the subconsciousness, whereby you don't even think what you're absorbing because, you know, there's part of art that is that goes behind the consciousness. And they're getting ideas through things like allegory, through portrayal of characters, through the plot structures and narratives and things like that in everything from television programs to theater to even if we take, for example, the stuff that is exhibited now. If you go into Saatchi & Saatchi, the Saatchi & Saatchi Gallery in London, which I have, and given an impromptu lecture on why that stuff is not art, well, you'll find that is the most deconstructive, anti-Western, you can't call it art, it's anti-art, really.
Yeah.
Anti-art, because it's against everything that traditional art said was art. And that is absolutely the case. It's quite deliberate, and it's sponsored. That is the thing. It is sponsored. And of course, if you look at Saatchi & Saatchi, they're from non-European backgrounds. They're Jewish, of course, and it's no secret that Jewish sponsorship has been behind a lot of this, although not exclusively, and we must not forget that many of our own people have had a great share in all this. But if you look at, for example, Tracy Emin's bed, well, what is that basically? Well, it's not art for a start. I can show you it's not art because it's the thing in itself. It's art. For art, you need artifice. Well, if it's the thing itself, then it's not artifice. It is the thing. So you can easily, you know, philosophically disprove that it's art. But one thing they always say is, oh, you know, it asks questions.
Right.
Well,
yeah.
But it's always the same question, isn't it? Which is it art? And this question, it's not even new, you know, it's 100 years old already, or at least, you know, in 2 years' time it will be. It was a guy from France, from Normandy, if I remember rightly, Marcel Duchamp, who exhibited a urinal on stage and called it a fountain, you know, and basically said, tell me it's not art.
Yeah.
So it's not even original what they're doing. It's already old. But yet it's kept in place because the bourgeois elites keep it in place, because it's anti-European, because it's anti-Western, because it's anti-culture. And if you look at, for example, the Communist Manifesto, it is, you know, Marx says that, you know, he doesn't want any culture. So...
Well, why do they need to eradicate that? Why is that so important, do you think?
Because a people without culture is a herd of animals. And you could, well, you would have to look at basically who wants to eradicate culture. And that is many different people for many different reasons. You also, you know, you have, as a lot of people have said, the Jews who have disliked us for centuries. That is a fact. They can't wait to kind of see our downfall. Although not exclusively the Jews, you know, because all other ethnicities, including our own, have their vanguards. You know, I'm part of our vanguard, if you like. Mm. The Chinese will have their vanguard. They're an up-and-coming people, as are the Mexicans, as are the Arabs. Everyone has their vanguards. And everyone would like to see the downfall of another people, because, of course, then they get their resources. That is nature. That is part of the struggle of nature. And anyone who forgets that would be extremely foolish. Unfortunately, we have, for several centuries, been led by the fools of our own people, the village idiots, if you like. It's a little more complex than to just to call them village idiots, I suppose. They're essentially mentally perverted, and they come from a certain caste within society that I call the bean counters. This is part of the middle class that deal in kind of finance, in the mercantile caste, if you like, that rose really out of the medieval age and took the place of the aristocracy over a period of time. And these people, they sort of live too comfortably, if you like. And part of human nature is that if you don't have an outside struggle, you will invent an internal struggle in your mind. This is why in that particular caste you have so many, you know, mental problems, so many pathologies and things like that, such as bulimia, anorexia, all that kind of thing, because they have no real struggle in life. And so the mind, if you like, wants struggle. It needs to struggle against something, because struggle is part of nature. And so it internalizes struggle, or they will adopt the struggle of someone else, the struggle of the other. But that is part of the internal struggle, which is kind of leads to self-detestation, and self-detestation externalized to the entire of their race, really. And that is what we're seeing. I've actually spoken with these people, with liberals, because of course, I've worked in education and in academia for over 10 years now, and some of them will be openly brazen about it. They will say to you things like, well, we should die out, you know, we're the worst people in the world, we've caused all the wars, we're horrible people, our extinction would be a benefit to mankind. To quote Susan Sontag, we are the cancer of humanity. But of course, Susan Sontag was Jewish, and she was throwing it at the white, at the white race.
Yeah.
So, but they will say, oh, you're right, Susan Sontag. We are the worst people. We are the cancer of humanity. And the sooner we go off the planet, the better, you know. And I always say to them, well, why don't you kill yourself then?
Go first. Yeah,
you exactly. But they kind of, in their psychopathy, really, they say, no, I justify my existence by telling other people that we all must die out. You know,
well, exactly. It's their job to make sure that everyone dies first, and maybe then they will kill themselves. But we don't know that.
That's so. Right. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Because of course, the first law of nature is one of self-preservation, and it's a very difficult one to override. So they kind of preserve themselves by saying, "You've got to go first. You know, you're the bigot, you're worse than I am, you've got to go first, and then I'll go." So that's how they kind of rationalize it, or at least one of the ways they rationalize it, because frankly, who knows what goes off in the mind of a madman.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, the difference as well, I think, is that the I don't know what, if we could just call it takeover. I mean, partially it is the takeover of the West, but it's also the the fall and the corruption of the West and Europe in particular, it's not necessarily done with force against us. It's something that's being done with our consent, with our admission, most of us anyway. And if we simply said no to this and turned it around, it would simply not happen. So I think the situation is quite unique if we compare it, let's say, with colonialism of the past, for example. Would you agree?
Yes, it's you're quite right in that, you know, if everyone turned around and said no all of a sudden, then it wouldn't happen. But the problem is that you've got the custodians of our culture in the hands of madmen, in the hands of people who detest themselves and others like themselves as an extension of themselves. So you're dealing with that. They are infecting the next generation through university studies, through secondary school studies, through primary school studies, through even through nursery now, because, you know, you're indoctrinating even at the lowest level. So, you know, you're getting this madness coming through each generation, and it's never ending. And this is the real problem, that, you know, you've got people growing up now who've never known any other ideas, who've never known anything different, who believe that it is perfectly natural to detest themselves, to detest people like them, to detest their own culture. That is the, you know, the great problem that we're facing here. And so it's a monumental problem, that is true. But it's not one that has no solution. It's not one that can't be rectified. And I always say to people, you know, it doesn't matter what they're doing. It doesn't matter what they're doing. We know what they're doing. What matters is what we're doing to combat that. And that's why I started the magazine, because I wanted a vibrant pro-European culture as an alternative to that way of thinking, to their, you know, to their anti-culture, and to say, look, you can go with that, or you can come over here. You can come over here. We're more vibrant. We're vitalist. We're, you know, we're the ones who have something to offer. They have only death and destruction. They will die out. Don't go with them. You know, don't be part of that. You can be part of us. You can be part of something better. So that's, that's where we are, really.
Yeah, it is. And I heard you say elsewhere, I think it was the London Forum you spoke at, and you said that basically if things continue as they do, society is going to break down because it's not built on anything. It's the very aspect of what they are bringing to us is deconstruction, right? It's a critical theory. It's destroying everything. It's not building up anything. And the end result of that is, of course, utter chaos and mayhem. Nothing is going to be left standing if they get their will through, right?
Yes, absolutely right. The whole idea of deconstruction theory. Well, the big idea of deconstruction theory, if you read Derrida, is to attack the logos itself, to attack logic. This is something that is, well, it's unprecedented. These sociologists in kind of the late 19th century, early 20th century, but getting, you know, ever bolder and ever to the nub of what underpins society. They sought, Derrida kind of distilled all that and got it, you know, right down to, you know, where to hit the hardest. And that is at logic itself, at reason. You know, attack Western reason, you will essentially, you know, create complete madness. You will destroy the entire society. Of course, Derrida was, as we all know, Jewish and had his reasons for wanting to see the end of Western society. But so many people have internalized this hatred of Western reason, hatred of Western logic, that a friend or someone at least who I know, Chris Jackson, National Front, he said we shouldn't argue with leftists. It's pointless, and he's right in a way.
Yeah,
it is pointless because they are insane.
Yeah,
absolutely insane because they have rejected Western logic entirely. And so this is the reason why you kind of go up to them with facts and things like that, and it has absolutely no effect on them whatsoever. You know, you just bounce off. You can point to whatever you want, but it will have no effect on the leftist whatsoever, because he has rejected logic itself. So Chris Jackson is right in a sense, but that is not to say that we should give up on the mass. The mass is malleable. The mass only goes along with things because, well, basically it's the mainstream, and the mass will always go with the mainstream. The art is really to take the mainstream, to get the mainstream back, and things will go back to normal quite quickly. That is
right.
A fact.
Yeah.
What do you have to do? And to be honest, nature is on our side. We must never forget that. That when we have the force of nature on our side, and so people will go back to normal very quickly if we take the mainstream. And the only way to take the mainstream is, quite ironically and paradoxically, is to be radical, because being radical is cool.
Exactly, yeah.
And because the left have taken the mainstream, that means they're no longer radical.
That's right.
And that means they're no longer cool. And they're not, when you look at it. You know, they're kind of whiny, they're not vibrant, they're kind of grey, pasty-faced people in, kind of flabby. I don't know if you've read Anthony Pohl's series of books, but there's a guy in there called Kenneth Widmerpool, and he's sort of this flabby, kind of sexually inadequate and physically inadequate person who's striving for power, and that is your average leftist, really. we have vibrancy on our side, we have vitality on our side, and I wish more conservatives would kind of embrace the more radical part of themselves and of the movement in general. And be more of a... I don't consider myself as a conservative. I consider myself as a revolutionary traditionalist. Because, well, let's be honest, if you're a conservative, what is there to conserve?
Exactly.
It's all gone. But I am a traditionalist in that I look back to European traditional culture, and I don't want to recreate that, because otherwise you'll make the mistakes of the past. But I want to take the lessons from that. I want to take the aesthetics, the things that pertain to us morally as Europeans, to bring that into the present and create things for the future, to create structures for the future. And that is the kind of tradition, a living tradition, that I would like to see.
Yeah, I think the conservatives have not yet realized that whatever they do, they're not going to be liked anyway. And I think there's still many of them are still stuck in that they're trying to, appease other people. They're trying to appease the left, for example. And it's never going to work. They're never going to like you, and it doesn't really matter, because what you say is true, Dave. But I mean, the window, if you will, the Overton window, whatever you want to call it, has been moved so far to the left, to a radical extreme position, that what you propose, or some of the things that I read about and the traditional art that we look at, I mean, that isn't really radical, but it's deemed radical today because, again, it's been, the window has been moved so far to the left, right?
That is absolutely true, yes. People don't realize where these ideas come from. They don't realize how radical these ideas actually are. if you went back 100 years, the society that we have now, it would, you know, it would seem to people as completely abhorrent. You know, if you transport someone from, you know, from kind of 1915, of course, we were in the middle of a war back then, but it, by the by, if you transported someone from then into the society that we have now, they would say, what the hell is going on here? Yeah. What's, you know, what's happened?
What happened
to the world?
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. And so, yeah, it's accelerated is the word as well. And it is, you know, ever accelerating. But as you said earlier, you said, you know, I welcome that acceleration when we were talking on the phone earlier, and I do too, because it will get conservatives to kind of realize what's going on, to say, hang on a minute, I can't be a conservative, I can't, you know, because there's nothing left to conserve anymore, and I have to put my foot down somewhere. You see, the problem with the conservative is he's a bit of a nice guy. You know, the sort of grey man. You know, he wants to kind of get on with his life and things. And we have to shake him a bit and say, you know, wake up, come on. At some point, you've got to put your foot down.
Yeah.
And that's been the problem with what has passed for the right, really, over the past couple of hundred years or so. You know, it goes quite a long while back, and personally, I would say even longer than that. But you know, every time the so-called progressives took a step forward, he took a step back and said, "Don't, you know, I'm drawing a line here. Don't come across that line. You know, don't come across that line. You know, I don't want you. Oh yes, you've come across that line. Well, I'm making a new line here. You know, and if you come across that, oh wait a minute, I'll just take a step back. But if you come across this, you know, and it goes on and on. And you know what they should have done is when they come across that line, stamp on their bloody foot and say, get back there, you prick.
Yeah,
you know,
that's right.
Which was at one time how the right really was. You know, the right is based on naturalist, you know, on natural ideas, on ideas that come from nature, from ideas of struggle, from aristocratic ideas. You know, when a king sensed a threat, he didn't kind of pussyfoot around. You know, he kind of went out with his sword and he slaughtered people. I said, right, you know, better all get back into shape, hadn't you? You know, when Edward the First, you know, people talk about Hitler. Oh, you know, well, frankly, Edward the First did what Hitler couldn't do. You know, he eradicated, you know, he got rid of the Jews out of his country. You know, so basically, you know, you have 1 week to leave. If you don't, you know, you're fair game. That's it.
Yeah.
You know, there was no arguing with that. The problem is that one thing that the left, first the liberal left, and then the socialist left, have brought in with them is litigation and bureaucracy and socialization and all this, and equally they have stamped out all these kind of primal ideas. These ideas that, especially the ones that are based on violence. If you look at, for example, two aristocrats had a quarrel, they'd go for a duel. You know, and at the lower level, you know, in kind of the working, of course it was the peasantry, but then the working class level, you know, there would be a fight in a pub. And they've stamped on that, these kind of bureaucrats, these liberals, and then the socialists. They want to manipulate society. They want to get rid of all that. And why do they want to get rid of all that? Well, it's because they're not virile, isn't it? It's because they're not, you know, the men are not masculine. They, you know, they're kind of weak and effeminate because, of course, they come from the bean-counting caste where, you know, they kind of hide in little offices and things and, you know, and say, leave me alone. That's why. And these are the kind of messages that we've got to get out there. That you know, these ninnies, these weak-minded fools. You know, they're running society, and they're running society to a level where it supports the inadequate.
Yeah.
And we need to get back to elitist ideas, to ideas that are vitalist, where you have both strength of spirit, of mind, and of body. And we need an art and a culture that promotes that. And that's the reason why I called it Mjolnir. One, of course, is because I'm a pagan and not a Christian. And so I suppose if I were a Christian, I might have called it the Rod or something like that. but I'm a pagan, I called it Mjolnir. Why did I call it Mjolnir? Well, because it's a big hammer, really, and also, a work of artifice. You know, it's a work of artifice that comes from the gods. When you strike with it, it brings forth thunder and lightning, and you smite your enemies with it. And that's what I want to do artistically, but equally, I'm not opposed to the idea of smiting them in any way, really.
Well, I think the proof for what you talk about, for what we need, is evident in the time itself of what we live right now. I mean, look at the state of things. Look at what the progressive suicidal class has done to our world when they've been left in control. Look at the state of everything, the attack on logic and reason, and it's causing chaos. Our world is literally falling apart. It's crumbling every day, and it's due to the fact that good men are not doing anything about it. And of course, new generations are being brainwashed into the established view and everything else. But the problem partially here is, of course, that it's not just that people are letting it happen. There are plenty of people who would like to do something against it, but they know that these people with the ideology that you've just been talking about are largely in positions now where they control some of the most powerful militaries on the planet. I mean, it's just not a matter of picking up a sword and fighting back these days, because you would have SWAT teams and military, if necessary, on the doorstep. They have nuclear bombs at their disposal if they so see fit to use it, you know?
Oh, yes, that is very true. This is the big joke, isn't it? That these kind of bean counters and self-haters and people with all these complexes are telling the people who are virile what to do and where to go, and who to kill whenever necessary. This is the sad fact of the matter, and I said a few things there, possibly quite immoderately, but we shouldn't kind of go out on some kind of of a frenzy or anything, because we'll lose, because sadly, people are manipulated to such a degree that they will fight against the people who only want their best interests, and that is a sad fact. So we have to fight. That is true, but we have to fight where we can win, and we have to kind of take each battle, each little battle as it comes. Either spiritually, either mentally, either physically, occasionally. There was, for example, National Action. Now, I know some of the young lads in National Action, and they're good lads, but they need to use a little more wisdom. They went out to Liverpool the other week. Now, Liverpool, for the benefit of people not in Britain here, Liverpool is essentially a red city. It has been for a long, long time, rather like Manchester. It's run by pretty much communists, hardline communists, and they run pretty much all levels of government, the police, and so on. Now, National Action who, do you know National Action, by the way?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah. They kind of went out on a little rally, on a march. They were corralled by the police. They were separated into small groups, quite deliberately. And so then the armies of Reds, of communists, and ethnic minorities and all their hangers-on and everything could beat them up, and apparently they gave them quite a severe beating. Now, it was quite foolish to, and I have all the time in the world for National Action. I think that they're a wonderful bunch of lads, and I hope they don't take this the wrong way. I hope they will learn from this. But basically, they should never have gone into Liverpool, mm-hmm. because you are going right into enemy territory. And I suppose they picked it because they thought, oh, we'll go into the worst part of enemy territory, the hardest part. But you will lose. You will lose dreadfully. The media will show you losing, and did do, apparently. They photographed them kind of taking beatings, and look, ha-ha, the fascists have been beaten, etc. And, of course, that goes into mainstream consciousness. People say, aha, wonderful, the fascists have been beaten, etc. And they did no good, either for themselves or for the movement at large. And they should have used a bit more wisdom. They should have gone to places, to a town or city where the public was more receptive to them, where the police were more receptive to them. Now, I used to, with the BNP, I used to go to either Rotherham or to Barnsley. Rotherham was not a good place. It's full of Pakistanis. You have the grooming scandal there, which I was aware of many years ago. And, I knew Marlene Guest, who was on Rotherham Council at the time, who was trying desperately to bring it to light for many years and to try to get the police to do something about it. And they wouldn't. They wouldn't. And that, people go on and they say, why wasn't anything done about, the grooming in Rotherham? People tried. People tried, and they were put down and told to shut up or else by the police, by the government, local government, etc. That is why the Rotherham grooming scandal, I call it grooming. I'm using the word here that the press use. I should call it what it is. Child rape scandal. That's what it is.
Of course.
It's a child rape scandal. I shouldn't use these euphemisms that they use. You see, that's the problem. They've got us all using these little euphemisms and things. It's a child rape scandal. That's what it was.
Yep.
By Asians, mainly Muslims, but not exclusively so. And as I say, the police there, they were unhelpful. But you went to Barnsley, and the police there, they would say, look, we've been told that we've got to come down hard on you if anything should happen, but we'll try to do our best, etc. They were quite sympathetic. So they should, National Action should have picked their target better. They should have gone into somewhere where it wasn't an impossible situation. Bravado, is one thing, and there's nothing wrong with bravado, but it has to be tempered with wisdom. You can't go out trying to fight losing battles all the time. We have to win. We have to win battles. That is a fact. And be seen to be winning. Because winning attracts winners. And if people sense that you're gaining ground, more people will join. Just like with the BNP. With the BNP, apparently there were 13,000 members at one time. That is not a small number. And a million people once voted for the BNP.
Yeah.
Why? Because they grew. They grew, and the more they grew, and the more they won, and the more the wind was with them, the more people they attracted. And it's sad, really, that it got taken down in such a fashion. But it's, you know, it can be recreated. You know, the people are still there. The people are still there to be recruited. 4 million people voted for UKIP. Was it 4 million or was it 8 million? I can't remember.
Yeah, I don't know either. It was.
Shall we go in the middle and say 6 million? It's amazing how often that number comes up.
The end there.
6 million. It's 6 million. Absolutely. And anyone who disagrees with me will face prosecution.
Yeah, it's a denial. That's good.
So anyway, you know, there are a sizable amount of people voting for UKIP. They might not be the best party, you know. Some people say, oh, you know, they're too liberal. But they're the kind of the furthest right that you can go at the moment. You can, of course, vote for the National Front. You can vote for the British Democratic Party, who are further to the right. Good parties, you know, I have nothing against them. But the party that is successful, that is furthest to the right, is the United Kingdom Independence Party. And, for you know, 6 million people voted for them at the last general election. They got one MP because of the first-past-the-post system. But had a few people more not voted Tory, not voted for the Conservatives, and gone with their guts and thought, I'm going to make a break for it, I'm going to vote UKIP, instead of going with their head, they'd have got a lot more. They'd have got a lot more power, a lot more MPs. We need to shift those. We need to kind of kick them along. We need to move them to the right. The way you do that is through culture, by shifting the culture, making it acceptable for certain views to be heard in public. And the way you do that is you do it through the arts. Because you know, if you're discussing a radical artist now. If you go back sort of to the radical artists of before, as I said earlier, Marcel Duchamp, you know, if you go back to him, you know, people were discussing him and his idea of putting one of these ready-made up on the stage, you know, a urinal, you know, most of the people at that time would say, oh, that's obscene. That's obscene. That's awful. But yet, people discussed it. People discussed it, and that's what you have to do in the arts. You have to get things out there and get people discussing it, because as soon as people start discussing it, you're creating an acceptability in public discourse, and people then will start to say, "Well, you know." Bit of, you know, racism, this and the other. I don't really care about it, you know. This artist over here, you know, he's been called a racist, you know, but he's obviously an intelligent guy, etc., etc. And it, you know, it comes from that. So, yeah, there are many things. There are many things we can do. Some things we can do, obviously. Is to change the discourse. Some things we can do is to get radical ideas into discourse. And some of the things is to target places where we can win, and target people where we can win. You know, the arts, again, you know, it's only going to be it's only going to be certain people who are receptive to the arts. The same with anything, really. It's horses for courses. You need different structures for different people.
Exactly.
And I'm always talking about this, about building parallel structures, building rather like what the Irish nationalists did at the end of the 19th century. The Irish nationalists, of course, they were successful. Why? Because they got a living and breathing culture. They got people involved in it, you know. Yeah. So there was the Gaelic Athletic Association for, you know, for athletes, for people who concentrated on the body. They got the, you know, they had the Celtic Twilight, the literary movement, with people like W.B. Yeats, Lady Gregory, John Millington Synge, and so on. You know, so they had horses for courses. They had different things for different people. They had language associations as well to keep the Gaelic language alive. And so, you know, different people could be attracted to the movement through different structures. And that is something that we have to emulate. Mine, you know, Mjolnir magazine is only one thing. There has to be many others. And there are starting to be many others. We were talking on the phone the other day about Wynne White, this little kind of community that's being built up by Nick Griffith, Chris Telford, people like that, you know, to build a kind of community where people can go, they can be themselves, they can feel comfortable, and they can get involved in various activities. There are things like Sigurd Legion, which is run by a friend of mine, Matt Tate.
Yep.
Where people can go, they can train, they can, you know, they can train for martial combat, they can, you know, they can get physically fit, they can go out on camps, that kind of thing. That is another great structure. There is National Action, where kind of young radicals can kind of group, they can meet, they can go on marches in the right place, of course, you know, and do, you know, kind of happenings and things like that. So these things, and the London Forum, I have to mention the London Forum and its spin-off, the Yorkshire Forum, which, you know, which is run by Jess Turner and Jim Luthwaite for the Yorkshire Forum. And these are, you know, these are great think tanks, rather like the Fabian Society was over a century ago, and still is actually for the left. Of course, Blair and Brown both came through that.
Oh yeah,
yeah. And but also, you know, it's been a very big think tank for a considerable amount of time. 1884, of course, it was. It was started.
Well, it's a long term thing, that, and that's what's so important here that we have to keep in mind. You know, we're going to take a break in a little bit here, Dave. But I just want to mention that that I think it is very important to pick your battles, and at the same time, I know that time is of the essence, but you have to know where to put in your effort and make it worthwhile. And you know, I don't have anything against striking at the root, but sometimes you do have to thrash through the branches to get to the root, and that's about choosing your battles and winning those battles too, because, you know, as it is right now, it's not with swords and you know, guns and bullets and everything else, at least not yet on that level, but it is a metapolitical battle. It's about you know, encouraging and showing a culture that is worth preserving and defending, and also living that culture, because it's, you know, most cases we look at it as something that's, you know, in a glass, you know, prompter or, you know, something that we look at, we don't interact with it, or we don't live it and engage in it. And if that's the case, it will always be foreign to us in some regard. And that's something we have to come away from as well, I think.
Yes, you're quite right. You're quite right. One of the things that was so successful in the last Labour administration in Great Britain, you know, I talk about Great Britain because obviously I'm from Great Britain, but
sure,
and so that's kind of the culture that I know. I know less about what has happened, especially in America, for example. I know little about that, so I don't talk so much about that. That's for other people to talk about. But in Britain, the last Labour administration, so kind of Tony Blair, Gordon Brown, what they did so well to destroy culture was basically to take funding away from anything traditionalist and to give funding to anything that was non-Indigenous European. The Celtic nations they were sort of ambivalent towards because they saw it as a way of hating the English and a way of destroying English culture, through kind of basically getting everyone ganging up against the English. But of course then, you had kind of the Irish, with their arms around the Asian Muslims and the black Africans and everything, saying, we all hate the English together. That's one of the things they did well. And they did it really because they stopped funding for English things and they gave it to ethnic minorities instead. So, they will fund things like the Notting Hill Carnival to death. They'll give, they'll give millions of pounds to, to provide funding for that. They will give millions for the gay pride festivals and all those things. Anything that is against the norm, they will fund. They will take funding away from anything that is traditionalist. I was at the Whitby Folk Festival the other week, and it was really saddening to see that there are now only 5 groups of sword dancers in the entire of the United Kingdom.
Mm.
5 groups left from a tradition that was once very vibrant. There were 2 groups there who I saw, and there were again Morris dancing. Is dying out. It's always mocked on the BBC. It's always lampooned, and yet this is our indigenous culture. They'll always show kind of people who are a bit kind of they do it a bit namby-pamby, a bit kind of. Effete kind of way, but if it's done properly, it's very virile. These people, these were kind of one of the guys who was a great strapping sort of, 6 foot. It was about 6'8" or something like that. He even towered over me, and I'm 6'2", and kind of dancing around. It's kind of. If you like, it's almost part march. It's you hit sticks and things like that. If it's done properly, then it's very virile, very kind of masculine and so on.
Yeah.
Although there was a feminine, there was a female group there, but they of course had their own dance and everything. But that is part of a natural and organic society. Every society has its dances. Every people have their dances that pertain to them. Now, I have nothing against, African dances or whatever. That is what, that is their culture that pertains to them. And they should have it,
Sure.
I'm not against that. I think that, that is a good thing because that keeps their culture alive well and keeps their people alive and well. But if you look at what's on the BBC, they're always mocking and putting scorn on ours. And that is kind of the hypocrisy of such as the BBC, which was just a mouthpiece for the last Labour government. And they will kind of mock our culture, mock our dances that pertain to us,
yep.
And say, ridicule it. But then they will turn around to this African dancing and say, "Oh, how wonderful that is! Look
sure.
at it! Look
yes.
at it! This is organic. This is marvelous." But if we have an organic culture, then that is evil, or it's ridiculous, or it is hateful, or whatever. And that is how people operate. And that has come down right from the top, from the government and from the media. They're all the same people, basically,
yeah.
and they all interchange jobs and so on and so forth. So one of the things that I said, the last Labour government, they defunded. sort of traditionalist, indigenous cultural activities, and they gave it to the ethnic minorities. And that still goes on, of course, you know, under the so-called conservative government of now, although it isn't, of course, conservative in any stretch of the imagination. I should say it's not conservative. It's not Tory, anyway. It's not right-wing.
Yeah.
And basically, it doesn't matter, or it shouldn't matter, if they defund it, because we're responsible for our own culture. And the sort of the natural elites in and among us have to kind of stand up and say, well, you know, it costs nothing. What does organizing a dance group cost? Peanuts, really.
Yeah.
Doesn't cost that much. All you need is a hall. You know, you kind of club together, you get a bit of money, you know, and you go there and you practice. You need a CD player to play a tape, to play a CD of the money, of the folk songs and things like that, and you practice. It doesn't cost anything. It's like with Mjolnir magazine. What does that cost? You know, every issue it cost me about £1,500, something like that. And you know, I work hard for that, and you know, I get quite a bit back from sales, of course, and everything. You know, it still cost me a few hundred, but what's that? You know, I could spend that on any hobby.
Well, if we can't invest any of that, then we don't. What's worth preserving if we can't even make that decision? I mean, exactly. You're right. I mean, it's not about you know, relying on a government that it's largely against us to protect and procure and do the job for us. That's my point there. We need to get involved in such a way that we live what we want to preserve and be out there as role models, really, in a place where so much is anti role model. It's anti heroism in our times today, you know. So there's so many aspects, you know, Dave, to what you just mentioned that I definitely want to ask you more about in the second segment and pick up on here. But before we take a short break here, let's just give out some details about the magazine, how people can get copies of it. Give us the website and those details.
Well, the website is www.mjolnirmagazine.com. www.mjolnirmagazine.com. You can order copies via the website. So there is a purchase page where you can go and you can order your copies online. Or equally, you can send us a check. And there is the address to send a check to on the website. So that's, that's where you get your information from. There is also a contact page for anybody who wants to send us submissions for possible inclusion in future magazines. We don't pay. I will tell you that straight out. We do not pay anyone for anything that they submit, because there is no profit for me. There is no profit for anyone. In fact, even if Mjolnir magazine were to make a profit in the future, then I would spend it on a cultural project yet to be determined, but certainly I wouldn't get any profit from it, and neither would anyone else. I may in the future create a prize, a literary or artistic prize or whatever, but we will see, you know, at a future date. But at the moment, it doesn't make a profit, so, you know, I make a loss every time, so I don't see any reason why I should pay anyone. So that's the size of it. But basically, the standard has to be professional. I am an elitist. It has to be of a standard that is over and above the level of the left. And of the, well, that's a bit of a...
that's setting the bar low.
I shouldn't really say that, because theirs is so bad. But
exactly.
Yes, but it has to be of a professional standard, and of a standard that would hold up in any era, basically, of art. So we've had people, you know, like Dragos Karadzic, sadly, he's dead, but his daughter sent us some of his work very kindly. We've had Charles Kraft, we've had Julie Howard Hobson, a continuing relationship with Julia Howard Hobson, which is wonderful, the finest poet in the English language at the moment, I think. But, you know, of a professional standard, but you do not need to have already been published or anything like that. We will judge on its merit. That is the key thing. So, you know, anyone whose debut it is, who comes up with something marvelous, then that is equally wonderful.
All right. Very, very good. We'll talk a bit more about some of the things that are contained in the magazine in the second segment as well. But folks, we'll have the website up on redicecreations.com. So go there to check it out. And we'll continue and pick up in the second segment with Dave Yorkshire. So stay with us, everybody. We'll be right back. Well, don't miss the second hour with Dave Yorkshire as we continue at redicemembers.com. We have much more to discuss about art, creativity, film, and also how to create an underlying interest in our own people and our own survival. It is truly a crisis on multiple levels that we are faced with right now. And in the second hour, we consider further what should be done to reverse it and take it all in a new direction. Sign up for a membership if you haven't already. Get access to a unique, bold, and truly independent radio program, news, and media production website that is concerned with the questions that the mainstream media deny, suppress, and pretend isn't issues of concern. But we all know that they are. Make sure that we can do more and expand and produce more that reaches more people. We want you to assist us in this process. Number one, sign up for a membership. This is the best way to help us right now. Second, contact us and say that you want to help out. Share with us your talents and perhaps we can work together towards one of the most important goals that there is. And third, tell your friends and family about us as well. Share some of our shows with them and help to get the word out. Well, thank you so much for listening, ladies and gentlemen. We have much more coming up for you in the second hour at redicemembers.com. You have access to over 1,000 radio programs, videos, inside episodes, and much more. We'll see you on the other side of this break.